everybody. Welcome back to another episode of On The Mix. I'm your host, Lindsay, and welcome to a new year. It's 2024, and this is the very first episode in the new year. So while I was hanging out on the Christmas holiday, I was watching a couple of different shows, TV shows, throughout the various different like platforms like Netflix and Amazon Prime. And I came across one that was really interesting. I forget what it's called, but it was all about Phil Spector, who is a really famous, very famous music producer who was famous predominantly in the 60s, the 70s, the 50s. Anyone that you imagine from that time, he worked with them, basically. And everything that he touched turned to gold when it came to music. But there was a very scary dark side to him that I never really knew fully about. I'm aware of the story that I'm going to be sharing with you, but I was not aware of his history that really predates what happened. So as you can probably tell by the title of this podcast, I'm going to be talking about the murder that Phil Spector was involved in with this actress Lana Clarkson back in the early 2000s. This was massively popular. The trial was televised, the first trial anyway. And it's extremely interesting to see how this man can really fall from grace in the eyes of the public, but also how we had no idea what he was like behind closed doors, because people really thought that he was just this mogul in the music industry, that he worked with so many amazing people, which I'll be sharing with you in a minute, and that he just almost all of a sudden became this murderer, or at least that's what people thought. So it's a really crazy story. It's very horrific as well, honestly. So trigger warning for talks of violence, for obviously the talk about murder that's going to happen. So if that triggers you in any kind of way, then maybe this is not the episode for you. But I just wanted to preface that. So let's just get started with talking about Phil Spector's background. Who is Phil Spector? What did he do? How did he become this absolute amazing person in the music industry? Well, he was born Harvey Philip Spector, and he was born on December 26, 1939, the day after Christmas. So he was almost a Christmas baby. But what set him off to kind of, I think, be the catalyst for his absolutely insane life was the fact that when he was only 10 years old, his father, whom he loved very much, he was going through a really hard time. It's not entirely certain how his father came to this point, but he took his own life. And how he took his own life also has been a little bit of a cause of speculation. We do know that he hooked up some kind of exhaust to his car and he killed himself that way by, and you know, inhaling the fumes. But it's also a bit of a lore that Phil would tell people that he killed himself by putting a gun to his mouth and killing himself. So it's almost like a really weird tale that he weaves throughout his life, that he tells people his father killed himself. And it's a really odd kind of thing, but it's said that his father was going through debt. And at this time in the 40s, the 50s, you know, when men were seen as the breadwinners of the family, if you weren't bringing home money to your family and you weren't having a great professional career at all, that, you know, I think you were seen as maybe less than a man. And some people at that time, I'm sure, would have rather taken their lives. And Phil's father was no stranger to that. He was of that kind of caliber from back then. So that's extremely unfortunate that his father killed himself. But I think that is the catalyst for how Phil became the kind of man that he was, because that obviously impacted him very deeply when he was only 10. What's very interesting, though, and will be sort of kind of like a foreshadowing, on his father's gravestone were the inscribed words, "To know him was to love him." And if that sounds vaguely familiar to you, it should, if you know music. There was a song called "To Know Him Is to Love Him." And that was a song that was recorded by Phil Spector himself. And it was used multiple times. Many covers have come about from that song. The Beatles famously recorded that song. So that's how I know that song personally, but it's a very famous song. So in 1953, only a couple of years after his father's suicide, his mother moved the family to Los Angeles, where she found work as a seamstress, and then he went to school in Los Angeles. And it was here that he learned to play the guitar, and he formed this group with his friends Marshall, Harvey, and Annette called the Teddy Bears. So the Teddy Bears had a couple of hit singles, but not really a lot. And it was shown in the documentary as well that Phil was extremely particular with how he wanted his songs to be presented, because he would write the songs. He was not only a songwriter, but he, during this period, would also kind of take somewhat, if you will, I'll just say internship loosely, but he took inspiration from record producers of the time, predominantly Stan Ross, who was the co-owner of Gold Star Studios in Hollywood. He would be tutoring Phil on record production. So he was extremely particular with how he wanted his records to sound. And he would yell at Annette all the time to not fuck up singing his songs. Like, there was a moment where they were performing that song, To Know Him Is to Love Him, live on television. And there was a moment where she was really making sure that she hit the high note, because she was in a lower register. And when they were rehearsing the song, he yelled at her and said, don't fuck up my song. And so she was really scared that she would mess up on live recording, but she did great. So even then, in that kind of early instance, that really goes to show the kind of character that Phil had. And it was said that Phil wasn't really an attractive man. He definitely was not extremely attractive. And he was, I think, a little short for the time as well. And people knew that he was maybe a bit awkward socially. So he came from really hard knocks life, obviously, with his father killing himself, but also with how he viewed himself as well. And he didn't really fit in with a lot of people. And he didn't want to be taken for a fool, let's just say that. He didn't want people to mistake him for anyone else. He wanted to be known as this man that was this really famous record producer and this very serious songwriter. So even from the very beginning, he was already showing his proclivity for a sort of controlling nature over women predominantly. So that song that he made with the Teddy Bears, To Know Him Is to Love Him, reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100 singles on December 1st, 1958, and it sold over a million copies. So he would work with the Teddy Bears for a little bit of time until he disbanded them. And in late 1961, Phil then began to really pursue his record producing career. And he found three groups that he wanted to produce. Two of them were already taken, but there was one group called the Crystals that he was adamant that he produced. And the Crystals at this time were huge, huge. Like, he really did a great job of managing the Crystals, because the Crystals are very similar to another band that he helped to produce called the Ronettes. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the Ronettes song Be My Baby, which released in 1963. That was a song he produced. It went to number two. So those kind of songs from back in the day, those kind of like Be My Baby, He's a Rebel, the bubblegum pop stuff, he worked with those groups and he created those songs, and he worked with a lot of great songwriters of the time to create these songs. But what was really weird, though, was he kind of formed this relationship with the lead singer, Ronnie, of the Ronettes. In the documentary that I watched, it was said by the other members of the Ronettes that Phil Spector was not Ronnie's type at all, but he kind of took her under his wing. And it was the thing where he had that control over the women. And he didn't do that with the men. He only did that with the women that he would take on and help produce. That he would really treat them like shit, honestly. He would yell at them. He would scold them all the time. And he would have this idea that they were just tools for his fame. So it's weird, though, that he formed that relationship with Ronnie. So much so that he actually married her in 1968. And at that time, he had a lot of success. He also worked with the Righteous Brothers for the song Unchained Melody, which is also very popular. So he helped them with that as well. He worked with, again, all kinds of people. You can think of Tina Turner he worked with. Like, he worked with all of them. All of them from the time that you can imagine, he worked with them. So he kind of, in a somewhat way, semi sort of left the public eye in 1968. So in the forming time in the 70s, he kind of took a little break. And that's when he married Ronnie. And in that time, he adopted three children with Ronnie. And so they had a bit of a family. I would think Phil's most famous contribution to the music scene, at least in my opinion, was when he helped the Beatles produce the Let It Be album. So, of course, the Beatles created the Let It Be album to go alongside what was thought to have been this recording, like a sort of live taping, this live concert that they were going to be doing alongside the documentary of the film, the Let It Be film. They really thought the album was just horrible. The material that they created, they thought it was awful, that there was no salvaging it. Phil Spector worked with John Lennon prior to the Let It Be album. He worked with John's single Instant Karma, and John loved what Phil did with it. So Phil was brought on by John and George to take on the task of turning Let It Be into a somewhat usable album. So, you know, in the 70s, he became a bit more reclusive. He didn't really feel like he wanted to produce that much, but a serious incident happened with him in 1974 when he was seriously injured when he was thrown through the windshield of his car in a serious car crash in Hollywood. He was almost pronounced dead on the scene, actually, but it wasn't until a police officer that was on the scene noted a faint pulse that stopped him from being declared legally dead. So he was very close to death. And you know, as much as I kind of hate to say this, that would have been probably the best thing that would have happened to everybody moving forward, because Lana Clarkson would still be alive. And a lot of the women that he tormented in his life would not have gone through the absolute torment and abuse that they went through. So he was admitted to the UCLA Medical Center on the night of March 31st. And he suffered serious head injuries that required several hours of surgery, with over 300 stitches to his face and more than 400 to the back of his head. That's how severe this accident was. So most people maybe don't know the fact that he began to wear wigs at this point in time, which if you've seen the trial for the Lana Clarkson murder, you see like he begins wearing these ostentatious, very boisterous, like loud, crazy, absolute mad wigs. And he wanted to keep it a secret that he was wearing wigs. Like, I think he thought people didn't know that he was wearing wigs, that it was all his hair. He tried to make it seem like, oh, this is just my hair. But really, he was wearing wigs. But so he remained mostly inactive in the music industry through the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. So he's sort of kind of in a way semi sort of retired. I'm just putting that in his perspective. By the 70s, and so through most of the 80s, 90s, 2000s, he sort of was just kind of riding high, if you will, on the fame that he acquired in the 50s and the 60s. So that is the background of Phil Spector, of who that man is. But now we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of this podcast. So it's going to kind of be like a three-parter. That was the first part. This part now is going to talk about his history with women. And he has a seriously messed up viewpoint on how he treats women. It's really disgusting. It's revolting. And there's even more that I found out that I don't even think I want to even get into, to be honest, that involves his children. And I just don't even want to go there. He's just a horrible, sick person all around, but his violent side. So, as I mentioned before, he married Ronnie, who was the lead singer of the Ronettes, and he almost kind of sort of maybe groomed her to being subservient to him. So she married him. And again, Phil adopted three children with her. There was a story, I believe, that on Christmas Day one year, he surprised her by adopting a child. Like, this is our son. It's like, that's just really, like, who does that? You know, like, that's really weird. You know, treating a child as if, like, it's a present, you know, to your wife. I don't know. That, as if you would, like, present your wife with a dog on Christmas Day. Like, that's just weird, you know? So Ronnie had a memoir that she did called Be My Baby, How I Survived Mascara, Miniskirts, and Madness. And in her memoir, very, very brave of her to come out and say all these things that she did. She alleged that Phil had imprisoned her in his California mansion and subjected her to years of psychological torment. He also sabotaged her career by forbidding her to perform, and she escaped from the mansion barefoot with the help of her mother in 1972. So 2 years after that, in 1974, she divorced him. and she forfeited all future record earnings and surrendered custody of their adopted children to him, which is sad. It's like she just wanted to escape from his horribly violent life that she was subjected to and that he forced her to be in. And like I said, he also forced his children to do extremely heinous things, and his children hate him as well. So he's not just a woman hater. He is also an absolute piece of shit human being as well. And she alleged that this was because Phil threatened to hire a hitman to kill her. So her leaving and forfeiting all her record earnings and surrendering custody of the children. This happened, and she did it because she alleged, like I said, that Phil threatened to hire a hitman to kill her, which she believed would actually happen. And to be honest, I believe that would have happened as well, based upon what I have researched about him. So, but she is not the first woman that he subjected these horrible, heinous things to. Let's go to another woman, Dorothy Melvin. Dorothy Melvin was working as a professional manager for Joan Rivers at this time, and she dated Phil Spector between 1989 and mid-1993, so on and off for a couple of years. Dorothy described Phil as a very charming, lovable man when he wants to be. He's a wonderful person to be around, and when he's drinking and he gets to a certain point, then he totally loses it and becomes the demon. So one night in July of 1993, Dorothy visits Phil at his house in Pasadena, and during the evening, he drank a lot of vodka, as he had a proclivity to drink a lot. That's almost like his favorite pastime, not only abusing women, but drinking. He then disappeared for a while in his house while Dorothy fell asleep on the couch. And when she woke up, she discovered that Phil was pointing a revolver at her brand new car out of nowhere. So Dorothy screamed, "What the fuck do you think you're doing?" And Phil told her to go back into the house. Well, Dorothy kept screaming at him, and he wouldn't take that, so he hit her in the head with the gun and said, "I told you to get the fuck into the house." So Dorothy returned to the house, and Phil followed her and started going through her purse, accusing her of looking for things to steal and sell, as if she wasn't just dating him already for years at that point, and he didn't trust her, which is odd. So he told her to take her clothes off and go up to the third floor where she assumed his bedroom was. All the while, Phil was waving the gun around and sometimes pointing it directly at her. So at this point, Dorothy refused to take her clothes off, and because of her refusal, he hit her in the head with the gun, and she was terrified. She managed to retrieve her car keys and run out of the house and get into her car and start driving. But it wasn't until Phil said, "I told you to get the fuck out of my house," when she said the gate was closed. The gate was not opening. And he said, "Oh, the gate's not opening? Oh, well, let me get that for you." So it's almost like he changed demeanor all of a sudden. He opened the gate for her and she ran away. And she called 911 and made a police report when she was safe. So that right there is his MO for the most part. That is the typical workings of Phil Spector. He gets a woman that's really pretty, that he likes to be around. He drinks. And when he drinks, a different side of him comes out. Almost like the repressed version of Phil Spector and all the trauma that he endured in his life went through some kind of transformation, and now he's the devil reincarnate. And so he has no problems pointing weapons at women and threatening them to have sex with him. That's essentially what it is. It's a way to control women. It's a way to dominate and have power over women and say, "You're not rejecting me and you're not leaving me." So in 1994, there's another victim to his heinous actions, Stephanie Jennings, and she is a photographer with a professional interest in the music business. And she began a long-distance dating relationship with Phil Spector at that time. So in January of 1995, Stephanie was Phil's guest at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Inductee Awards dinner because he was going to be inducted. And there was an after party at the Waldorf Astoria. And at this after party, he was drinking heavily. And when he drinks, he began to be extremely unpleasant and making obnoxious remarks to the women and everybody around him. So what happens next is nothing short of something that's like out of an absolute horror story. Stephanie left the after party between 2 and 3 in the morning, and she took a taxi back to the Carlisle Hotel, where not only was she staying in a separate room, but Phil was also staying in a separate room. So she goes to her room and she tries to fall asleep when she hears a knock on the door, a loud knock on the door. So she is confused and she goes to the door and she opens it, and it's Phil's bodyguard standing in the door. And he asks Stephanie to join Phil in his room because that's what Phil requested. But she said, no, it's very late and I want to get some rest and I'm going to see him tomorrow. So he can just wait to see me until tomorrow. So goodbye. So she closes the door. She tries to go back to sleep. Another knock on the door, and it's again his bodyguard out the door. And he's like, Phil is insistent that you come see him in his room. And she says, listen, I'm tired and I just want to go to sleep. So tell him I will just see him tomorrow. Good night. And she closes the door. She tries to go to sleep again, but she hears another knock on the door that's different this time. So she's like, probably really annoyed at this point. She probably thinks it's the bodyguard again, but lo and behold, it's Phil himself now at the door. So she opens the door and Phil's right there. And he said, come and join me in my suite. And she declined. And she said, listen, I want to go to bed and I'm not doing this with you. So I'll see you tomorrow. But he would not take no for an answer, like the little weasel of a man that he is. So he got angry and he got upset. No women will ever reject Phil Spector, right? Is what he's thinking in his mind. So he comes in, he barges through the door, and he's yelling at her, demanding that she come with him. He reminded her that he was the one that was paying for her hotel room. So hanging it over her head, like, I'm the one that's paying for your hotel room. You owe me. So he threatened, if you don't come to my hotel room, you're going to pay for your own hotel room, and I'm not paying for it anymore. So she says, okay, great. I will happily pay for my hotel room if you just leave me alone. So at this point, he was irate and he went on the attack. He argued, he yelled at her. He was so irate with her. She started packing up her stuff and she said she was not handling this anymore. So she started to pack up her bags and she was about to leave. And this was when the argument became more heated. So at this point, she was in the bathroom collecting up her toiletries and he went into the bathroom after her. He laid his hands on her and he either slapped Stephanie or he pushed Stephanie. Either way, he put his hands on her. And this caused her to fall backwards onto the toilet, right, and lose her balance. And so when she got up, she pushed him back and he fell into the bathtub, knocking down the shower curtain. So can you imagine how he would have felt really embarrassed, right? That a woman got one over him, that she pushed him into the bathtub and he fell and he looked like a fool, right? So imagine how he was so seething with anger at this point that he silently gets up from the bathtub and he leaves the room and he closes the door. She probably thinks, okay, maybe this is done. Maybe now he'll leave me alone. But what she doesn't expect is that he comes back. When she finishes packing, he comes back into the room. He pulls a chair in front of the door. So he locks the door. He sits down in this chair in front of her. He blocks her exit and he has a gun in his hand. And he's waving the gun around, and he is sometimes pointing the gun at her face, and he's threatening her, saying that he will kill her, essentially holding her hostage in the hotel room. And so Stephanie was petrified. She was scared. She couldn't leave the hotel room because he was holding her at gunpoint. He literally was holding her hostage in her own hotel room. So she thought she was going to die. She thought, this is how I die. And so she's on the bed crying and pleading with him to let her leave, but he would not. So she makes the bravest move she could ever do. In the middle of this confrontation, in the middle of this hostage situation, she picks up the hotel room phone and she dials 911. But Phil stupidly thinks that she's calling her mother to say goodbye to her. And he says to her, your mom is not going to save you. There's no point in you calling her. You can call her all you want. He doesn't think that she's calling 911, the idiot. Doesn't think that she's calling 911 to help her out. And it's so crazy. But she calls 911 in front of him. But she can't say that she's being held hostage and she needs help. She can't outwardly say that because he's right there holding a gun to her face. So she tries to play it off like she's speaking with her mom, right? And the people on the other end, the 911 operator, they know that she can't outwardly say what she wants to say. So they smartly just get her to answer with yes or no, basically saying, do you need help? She says yes. So she's only saying yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And Phil is unaware of what's going on. So she gets help. She gets the help of police officers and they were dispatched and they came to the room with the hotel manager. But Phil somehow must have gotten some kind of intuition that, oh, maybe she called the police, and he leaves before the police arrived. So unfortunately, nothing was really done about that necessarily. And I believe Stephanie in the documentary herself kind of said that even the hotel themselves didn't really do a whole lot to protect her, which is so unfortunate. Going back a little bit in time into the 70s, let's go to Phil's other victim, Devra Robitaille. And I hope I say her name correctly. She is a British pianist, and she worked for Phil as the administrative director for his record label at the time called Warner Spector Records. And a year after she started working for him, they began a romantic relationship. So Devra frequently organized parties for him at his Beverly Hills house, and she attended these parties as an employee, not as a guest. At one of these parties, around 1975, the guests all had gone and Devra was standing in the foyer, very tired and wanting to leave. The door was locked, so she asked Phil to let her out. But Phil left the foyer for a few minutes and Devra was just standing there with her purse and jacket ready to leave, thinking that maybe he was gonna let her out, right? But she felt the barrel of a gun touch her temple and she freezes and she is petrified. She turns and she sees Phil holding a shotgun to her forehead. Not just a revolver, which would be bad enough, but a shotgun. How crazy is that? So he had been drinking that night, as you can well imagine, and he was extremely drunk. And she says that he said this to her: "If you try to leave, I'm going to blow your fucking head off." So threatening to kill her. When Devra, petrified, said that she had to leave, Phil swore and shouted at her, saying things like, "I'm gonna blow your head off. I'll blow your brains out. You can't leave. I'm not unlocking the door." He was still holding the shotgun to her head, and she stood her ground very bravely, saying, "Just stop it. This is ridiculous. I just want to go home." So she stands up to him, and suddenly in this moment in particular, his demeanor all of a sudden changes now, and she said this: "I remember him just sort of, I can't describe it in any other way. He just sort of relaxed, and the moment passed, and he went on and got the keys and unlocked the door and let me go. There was a little moment of suspension, and then he became Phil again. I didn't recognize the other maniac." So it's like a Jekyll and Hyde situation. It's like when he doesn't drink, he's a sort of nice, charming man. And a lot of people say that he was a charming guy, a very charming guy. But when he drinks, it's like he becomes this other kind of animal entirely. This is not even the last of his victims. I'm going to mention one more to you. Her name is Diane Ogden, and she worked in the entertainment industry. In 1982, after having been introduced by Phil's publicist, she accepted a dinner invitation from Phil himself. So at the restaurant, he drank alcohol. Obviously, he got very drunk. And afterwards, they went to tour his massive Beverly Hills house, which, by the way, he calls his castle because it's modeled after a 1920s Pyrenees castle that he thought was so cool. So his house is not just a mansion. It's a castle. Like, it feels like a castle. Not only that, but to the entryway to his house, you have to climb up about 80 steps to get to his front door. So imagine the absolute trek you have to do. It's all the way in the middle of the Hollywood Hills, but there's 80 stairs you have to climb up to get to the front door. So he is flaunting off all of his wealth, like, "Oh, let me show you around my castle." So after seeing his castle and talking with Phil, Diane said that she needed to go home because she had work the next day. Well, Phil did not want her to leave, and he was not going to let her just walk out. So he disappeared, and she got ready to go, thinking that, okay, well, maybe I'm going to leave now. So she puts on her purse, and she's ready to go. But then she hears a buzzer go off. Phil had locked the front door using a remote control. So that's kind of scary that he has a remote control to lock his door and front door. Most people would probably think that's smart safety precautions, but for a man like Phil to have that kind of mechanism is a bit scary because he can lock it remotely whenever he wants to, and you can't really unlock it because he has the control, and that is really scary. So Diane pleaded with him to let her leave. She begged him more, and he finally unlocked the door and let her leave. So when she was between jobs in 1988, she accepted Phil's offer to be his paid assistant. So she kind of thinks that the first incident was just maybe a weird thing that happened. And so she accepts this job a little bit later, like, okay, maybe he's changed. Maybe that was a one-time situation. Maybe he's changed now. So in March 1989, she went to his house where he was entertaining some people. And Phil, of course, he drank like an absolute sailor during the evening. And at about midnight, as people were leaving, Diane said that she was going home. And yet again, as his protocol says, Well, he didn't want her to leave. So his programming in his own brain is like, the women want to leave. I'm not letting them leave. So he threatens them. And he comes back into the house with a rifle, screaming at her, saying, you're not fucking leaving. Diane testified at the trial. Because when the trial happened for Lana Clarkson, they brought back all of the women that he had transgressions with. And Diane was on the stand. And she testified that he seemed to have become demonic. And she said he was talking and screaming, not being him. He was just like taken over by something. I don't know what, but he wasn't Philip. So Diane, scared for her life, she sits down and she abides by what he says. Phil then pointed a pistol at her, touching her face with it and screaming that he was going to blow her brains out. So he orders her to go upstairs at gunpoint to his bedroom where, still at gunpoint, he made her partially disrobe. You can kind of imagine what goes on from there. And unfortunately, that is his natural inclination, his MO. And it's weird because when he doesn't drink and when he comes off the drink and when he has his hangovers, it's like he's a totally different person. It's simply disturbing and very sickening that he thinks he has this absolute power over women that just want to leave. It has nothing really to do with him. It's just the fact that they have to go because it's late. But he thinks that that is the absolute rejection of all time. And so he cannot take a rejection. This, unfortunately, though, would end up being the catalyst to what ends up happening to poor Lana Clarkson. And she would end up being his victim. So who is Lana Clarkson? Well, Lana was born on April 5th, 1962 in Long Beach, California. In the early 80s, Lana landed parts in film and television, just got a little bit parts here and there, like extra work, if you will. She made her screen debut as a minor character in the famous high school film Fast Times at Ridgemont High in 1982. She also appeared in Scarface in 1983 as an extra. She volunteered also at the AIDS charity called Project Angel Food, where she delivered food for those in Los Angeles disabled by AIDS or HIV. And at that time, that was really heroic of her because people did not know how AIDS was passed. They thought it was, you know, obviously the gay disease. They thought, oh, well, you know, if you sleep with men, that's how you get AIDS. But obviously, the more time went on, they saw that that wasn't just the case. And AIDS, again, they thought it was a very, very scary, contagious disease. So when she volunteered to help those disabled by HIV or AIDS, that was considered at that time a very like revolutionary, heroic thing that she did. So that was just a really beautiful little tidbit I wanted to throw in there just to speak to her character and to who she was as a person. So as time went on, her career began to stall as she approached her 30s, and she wasn't really able to make a living as an actress, doing kind of B-movie type, C-movie type roles, and she sought out alternative sources for income. So at that time, she operated her own website at this time in the late 90s, and on this website, she sold autographed DVDs of her films, and she also communicated directly with her fans on her own message board on the website that she did, which I think is really cute and sweet, like to have an actress or an actor that you love communicating with you directly on forums or message boards at that time was something that was very unique because that technology was still very like primitive. So for her to do that was really ahead of her time. So that was sweet. Unfortunately, though, around Christmas time of 2001, she had an accident where she was dancing with her friends and she fell on the floor and she broke her wrists. She couldn't do anything. She couldn't act and she couldn't model for a long time. And the defense really used the incident of her breaking her wrists as a turning point. They were saying things like, well, this is the time where she then began to contemplate how happy she was and her possible suicidal tendencies. But that's not true at all. Her friends and family said that despite her wrists being broken, that she was absolutely extremely excited to keep pursuing her career when she got better. So eventually, of course, she did get better. And at this time in 2001, she was living in Venice. And she kind of thought, okay, how can I create parts for myself? How can I get back into the industry? So she did this really incredibly interesting thing where she did a sort of one-woman project where she wrote, produced, and directed a showcase reel titled Lana Unleashed. And essentially, this was to showcase all of the different types of characters that she could play. And she really wanted to do comedy. She started doing stand-up comedy at this time to kind of test the waters and see if people enjoyed her comedy. And people did enjoy her comedy. but she wanted to kind of create a reel where she would show off various kinds of parts that she would do. And this would be a way for her to give this to directors to almost be like an audition tape, to be like, hey, here's what I can do. Do you want me in your film? And that was the point of creating this showcase reel, which was very smart of her. So she was doing that. She was doing a bit of stand-up, and to create more ends meet for her, she took a part-time job as a hostess in early January of 2003 at the House of Blues in West Hollywood. And this is the one that Dan Aykroyd, the actor, owned and formed. So it became a really popular hotspot for very famous celebrities to come in and hang out in the VIP room, which is where part of this story is going to take place in. So she was trying to make ends meet, as I say, and she had prospects lining up for her to resume filming and modeling, at this time. So she was excited, you know, she was healing from her injuries and she was doing great. So she was happy and excited. But now is the third act, if you will, of this podcast, of this episode. And this is where we are going to get into the nitty gritty, the details of what happened that led up to her grisly end. So one of the key players in this story is Adriano D'Souza, and he was working as a valet parking attendant at this restaurant called The Grill in the Alley, and it's also known as The Grill, which was a Beverly Hills restaurant. And it was here at The Grill where he met Phil's chauffeur, who asked if Adriano wanted to work as Phil's backup driver. So Phil said, great, let's have this guy on, no problem. Adriano would occasionally drive Phil, you know, here and there. This wasn't the first time that he was doing it. He knew Phil, you know, and he was cool with Phil. Adriano was also Brazilian, and that comes into play later in the trial. He would be the backup driver for Phil on the occasion, and these backup driving jobs were arranged by Phil's secretary, Michelle Blaine. So the day in question was February 2nd, 2003, and this was on a Sunday afternoon. Michelle called and asked Adriano to drive for Phil that night. Adriano arrived at Phil's house in the early evening and prepared the Mercedes that he was driving Phil in. Very nice car. So Phil got into the car carrying with him a leather briefcase and told Adriano to drive to Studio City, where his friend Rami Davis lived. So Rami and him went back a long ways away. Rami had gone to high school with Phil and then met him again years later at a high school reunion. How interesting would that be to have Phil Spector at your high school reunion? That's kind of crazy. During 2002, they occasionally went out to dinner together, but they were not romantically involved. So they were just kind of casually seeing each other at this time. So Adriano picked up Rami at her place and then they drove to The Grill. Phil and Rami went inside for dinner and he appeared to be a bit intoxicated, let's just say that. So the drinking was starting at this point. They finished dinner between 9:30 and 10 p.m. and Rami wanted to get to bed early because she had work the next day. Another player in this story, her name is Kathy Sullivan, and she was working at The Grill that night as a server. She had a little bit of history too with Phil. She met him back in 1997, so she knew Phil for a bit of time. On this night, February 2nd, 2003, Kathy was the waiter that served and greeted Phil and Rami when they came to The Grill. So after finishing her shift, Kathy was eating when another restaurant employee came over and asked if she wanted her coworker Karen and herself to join Phil for a drink. And Phil had the proclivity to ask the waitresses to like join him at a drink, you know, at his table. So Karen declined though. She didn't want to do it, but Kathy went over to his table and accepted his invitation to go to another restaurant, Trader Vic's, and have a drink. So she's like, okay, I'm done with my shift. Phil wants to take me to get a drink. Sure, let's go. So at the Trader Vic's restaurant, Phil and Kathy went to the bar and he ordered a drink called a Navy Grog. And in the show, they make a very big notion out of it to say that a Navy Grog has so much alcohol in it that it's even amazing that he was like not knocked out immediately after having this Navy Grog. I never heard of this before until I had the show, but it's an absolute beast of a drink. And he not only orders one, but throughout the night, he orders so many more Navy Grogs and other kinds of drinks. So Kathy said she was tired, but Phil wanted to go to this other restaurant called Dan Tana's. So he literally was just having a night on the freaking town. Adriano arrived at Dan Tana's restaurant at about 12:30 a.m. with Kathy and Phil. So Kathy was like, I'm tired, but Phil wants to keep taking me out, so I have no choice here. At this Dan Tana restaurant, Phil ordered a daiquiri and Kathy ordered another amaretto sour. So they were both, you know, quite intoxicated. They also ate some food and ordered a second round of drinks. But this doesn't stop here. The last place that they go that Phil suggested they attend to was the House of Blues. Kathy agreed to go, although she really wanted to go home. So it's like she couldn't even really say no. So she goes. And at the House of Blues, when they arrive, Phil tries to go into this VIP room called the Foundation Room. And this is where a lot of the very wealthy, famous people go to hang out and sit and have drinks and food. And to get into this club, you have to be made aware of who you are. And you also have to have a wristband that shows that you are a VIP member. The security guard who worked at the House of Blues that night testified that he had been training Lana Clarkson to be a hostess and a security officer for the Foundation Room. So this is where Lana Clarkson will meet on this extremely fateful night, Phil Spector. So she is with the security guard and Phil comes in with Kathy. And he was a VIP client, but Lana stops him because he didn't have the wristbands to enter into the VIP room. And this is where Phil gets angry and he says, do you know who I am? Lana mistakes him at first for a woman. And she says, no, ma'am, I'm sorry. I don't know who you are, because he's wearing a long wig. Like, he's wearing a wig that has long hair. That just really humbled him. But unfortunately, that humbled him a bit too much, because then, you know, something kind of switched in his brain at that point. So the last key player in the story is Sophia Holgan, and she was one of the cocktail waitresses at this time. And she told Lana that, hey, that's Phil Spector. He's a very famous music producer and he's a multimillionaire. Just letting you know, like, that is Phil Spector. And she's like, oh, okay, great. Thank you for telling me. So she asked Lana to make sure to give Phil a seat in her section because she had previously been given a very massive tip when Phil came in previously. So she's like, hey, can you do me a solid, Lana, and make sure he goes over to my table because I want to wait on him. So Lana seats Phil and Kathy in Sophia's section of the Foundation Room. And she told them if they were going to order drinks, they had to hurry because it was getting late and the bar was going to be closing. At this point in time, we're getting into like 2 in the morning, very late. So Phil ordered a Bacardi 151, which is apparently a very expensive rum, which had double the proof of regular rum. So he is smashed. It's even amazing that he can walk and that he can talk. He is absolutely out of his mind drunk. He tried to order a drink for Kathy, but Kathy just wanted water. She didn't even really want to be there. She felt forced to be there. So he gets the hint and she said in her testimony that Phil said, oh, you want to go home? Fine, I'll have my driver take you home. Almost like, oh, fine, you don't want to be with me anymore? Fine. So Kathy initially thought that Phil was being perceptive and thoughtful, but then he shouted, get Lana. And when Lana came over, he said, I'm sending Kathy home, take her home. So obviously Kathy being a little, you know, tipsy herself, Lana helps to escort Kathy to Adriano, who's sitting in the Mercedes. And Lana told Adriano to take Kathy home and then to come back to the House of Blues because obviously that was Phil's driver, so he needed the car as well. So meanwhile, while this was going on, while Adriano was taking Kathy home, Sophia served the water that was intended for Kathy, but Phil says, I don't want it. I don't want that fucking water. And Phil downed his alcoholic drink in one swallow. Very scary. He asked Sophia to have a drink with him. So yet again, his girl of the evening leaves, and so he needs another one to feel like he's a man, I guess. So he asked Sophia to have a drink with him. But when she explained that she couldn't have a drink with him because she was working, Phil asked her to go home with him instead, which, yeah, that's great. When you can't have a drink with me, can you at least sleep with me? But Sophia said she couldn't because she had something to do the next day. So again, he's being rejected left, right, and center. At first, Lana mistook him for a woman. She didn't know who he was. And now he's being rejected by the Sophia woman who's like, I can't go home with you or have a drink with you. So after Kathy left and after all of that happened with Sophia, Lana came back into the room and according to Sophia, she began fluffing up the pillows on the couch and making small talk with Phil. Sophia testified that that's not how Lana usually behaved with customers And to her perception, it seemed like she was doing that because she had learned that Phil was a wealthy VIP member. But whether that's true or not, she does not deserve what happened to her. Let's just say that outright. So Phil is making small talk with Lana Clarkson, and he told her to have a drink with him. But because she was working, she had to get permission from her manager, who said, "You can sit with Phil, but you can't have a drink because you're on the clock," right? So after Phil finished his Bacardi 151, he asked for another drink. He just keeps guzzling down the booze. But Sophia said she needed the manager's approval because of the time, how late it was. And the manager refused to approve any more drinks, so they closed out his tab for the night. So he's like, "Well, I can't drink anymore and it's getting too late." So Phil asked if Lana needed a ride to her car, and Lana said yes, that she did. He then asked her, "Do you want to go to the house so that we can talk?" So again, he brings up the suggestion of let's go back home for the purpose of for sure sleeping with these women. That's the whole point. He wows them with his magical castle in the Hollywood Hills, and he wows them with his fame and his money and his wealth, and then he takes them to his room and he wants to sleep with them. But it turns out that they don't want to do that, so he gets mad, right? So this is how it starts with him. He's like, "Do you want to come back to my castle?" But Lana said she needed to work the next day and she just wanted a ride to her car that was parked in a nearby parking garage because it was late and I'm sure she didn't want to walk by herself, you know? That makes sense. But Phil kept pestering her. He's like, "Come back home, come back home, come back home with me." And she kept saying, "No, no, 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 I can't." But, you know, he takes her to get her car at the nearby parking garage, and she was just being bombarded and pressured, and she was like, "I seemingly have no other option." So she gets back into the car, and she tells Adriano that she's just gonna go back for a drink, that that's it. But Phil gets upset, and he screams at her and says, "Don't talk to the driver." So crazy, like, "Don't talk to anyone else but me. You can only talk to me." So Adriano ends up driving Phil and Lana back to Phil's house, and it was noted that by Adriano's testimony that Phil and Lana were watching a movie on the DVD player, the portable DVD player that Phil had in the back seat, and they were laughing, so they seemed to be having an okay time. So they got to his house at about 3 a.m. So imagine this scene, if you will. It's 3 a.m, it's pitch black, it's very dark out. He's very drunk, and he can barely hold his weight up, right? But he has 80 stairs that you have to climb up in order to get to the front door. So he's stumbling, he's trying to walk up these stairs, and she's like having to hold on to him to get up to the door. It's dark. It's late. She doesn't really know this guy. She doesn't really want to be with him. And she probably feels really scared. I would feel really scared at this point in time. Like, it's just too much. So while Phil was taking Lana into the house, Adriano collected some of the things that was left in the back of the Mercedes, which was Phil's leather briefcase, some cell phones, and the DVD player. So after a short period of time, when he got Lana situated in the house, he came back out the back door of the house, and Adriano handed him the DVD player. So he walked back into the house. Adriano was like, "Okay, you know, I'm gonna leave Phil's briefcase by the front door, and then I'm just gonna wait to take Lana home whenever she wants to go home." So he sits in his car and he waits. So at this time, it's about 3:30 a.m, and he's just sitting there, right, until it's time to go. So about an hour and a half passes. I'm not sure if Adriano slept or if he just sat there twiddling his thumbs. But at 5 a.m, Adriano was startled by a sharp noise that he heard out of nowhere. So he's frightened. He gets out of the Mercedes to investigate. He walks around. He goes to see if he can see anything. And for a couple of minutes, he couldn't find the culprit for that noise. So he's like, "Okay, this is odd." So he goes back into the car and he shuts the door. But a few seconds later, Phil opened the back door of this house. And this is where Adriano can see him walking towards him. So Adriano gets out of the Mercedes, because he's like, "Oh, okay, maybe it's time now for me to take Lana home." So Phil is walking towards Adriano, but Adriano can see that Phil is holding a revolver in his right hand. And this is where Adriano says that Phil said this, "I think I killed somebody." Adriano testified he had no problem hearing what Phil said, that he heard this. And he was very consistent with his testimony that he heard Phil say, "I think I killed somebody." I brought up earlier the fact that he is Brazilian and that he is not originally a native English speaker, but in the trial, the defense was trying to paint Adriano as a less than credible source because Adriano is really the only witness to what Phil said and to what happened. And they're trying to discredit him as much as possible. So they're trying to say, "Oh, well, we know that English isn't your first language. So do you think that maybe you heard him say, 'I think somebody's been killed'?" And Adriano's like, "No, I know that I heard him say, 'I think I killed somebody.'" So it's really sick. Like, Adriano was interviewed in this documentary and he said, "They thought because I spoke with an accent that I think with an accent." And that's crazy that even back in the 2000s, the early 2000s, that kind of blatant prejudice was being brought to the table. Again, they tried to discredit Adriano in any possible way, but Adriano is a very smart man and he harbored a lot of guilt for what happened too as well. You know, because again, he was there, he was the only witness to what happened, and he was very, very touched emotionally by the whole entire thing in the documentary. It was very, very moving. But so he hears Phil Spector say, "I think I killed somebody." And Adriano at the time thought that he saw a little bit of blood on Phil's right index finger. And so behind Phil, Adriano notices that he can see a pair of women's legs through the open back door. So he thinks that's Lana. So he goes, he walks in to the door. He steps to the side to get a better view and he could see Lana's entire body. So how you can visualize this was the back door to the house is open. And in the foyer, you can see a chair off to the side and you can see a spiral staircase. On the left side of the spiral staircase is where Lana's body is. So she's in this chair and she's like slumped, laying backwards, almost somewhat kind of vertically in this chair. Her legs are like spread out. Like, you know, it's a really harrowing scene. There's blood everywhere. There's blood all over her. And she has her purse slung over her shoulder as if she was ready to leave. So Adriano is frightened. He asked Phil what happened, and Phil, all he can do is shrug his shoulders and he say, "Nothing." He said nothing. He literally was like blank. Nothing came from him. So Adriano got scared and he realized that Lana was probably dead. So he started running away from the house, literally on foot, running away, forgetting the fact that he even had his car. So he runs down the street. And he tried to use his cell phone, but he was so disoriented that he couldn't manage it at first. But then he's like, "Oh my God, I forgot I have the car back at Phil's house." So he's running back up the driveway into the Mercedes. He got in the car and this is where he drove to the main entrance gate. So when he thought that he was safe and he calmed down enough to use his phone, the first person he called was his secretary, Phil's secretary, Michelle Blaine. Because again, he was so disoriented, but he did not know what Phil's address was, right? He didn't know it. So he didn't remember it. So Michelle's number was programmed into Adriano's phone, and this is where he called Michelle because he needed to get Phil's address. So Michelle didn't pick up initially because, you know, it was 5 a.m. It was very early. So he left her a voicemail that said, "Michelle, it's Adriano. You have to come to Mr. Phillips' house. I think he killed a lady. Please call me back. Please call me back. I'm going to call the police right now." So it was only in a span of about 2 minutes between when he saw what happened to where he called the police. And the call to the police was recorded at 5:02 in the morning. So the officers very quickly were able to come to the address because they were not too far away from his address. So the officers arrived on the scene and this is where they noticed Lana's body. So again, her legs were extended straight out in front of her and her left arm hung over the side of the chair and her right hand was draped over the right arm of the chair resting on her purse. The purse straps were wrapped around her shoulder and somewhat twisted and then wrapped around the right hand arm of the chair, twisted in an unnatural fashion. There was blood on her face and blood on her chest. And underneath Lana's left calf was a 38 caliber six-shot Colt Cobra revolver. The gun was loaded with 5 rounds and one already went off, and the gun was bloody. A part of Lana's artificial tooth had been lodged in the front sight of the gun, so practically like, you know, around the barrel of the gun. And more pieces of her artificial teeth and her teeth were found all across the floor of the foyer next to her body. And next to Lana was a side table. And one of the drawers was partially open. So they look inside the drawer and they find a leather holster that this revolver in question fit perfectly into. And across from the foyer, there's a bathroom. And in the bathroom, her false lashes were on the top of the toilet tank, so she took her eyelashes off. And on the floor of the bathroom was a diaper covered with blood. And in the toilet, there was blood. What they pieced together was that Phil shot her point blank in the mouth. He put the barrel of the gun into her mouth and he pulled the trigger and he killed her instantly. And in the midst of him trying to maybe scramble to figure out what to do, he has a diaper nearby in the bathroom. And he put the diaper either in the sink or in the toilet to wet it. And he tried to like clean the blood off of her face. And that's when he then like tried to put the blood in the diaper in the toilet so he could flush the blood down the toilet. When the police officers came to the scene, her blood had already coagulated. So that means that Phil took his absolute time in trying to clean her up. On the second floor of his house was the master bedroom, and inside the bedroom closet was a white stained jacket with blood on it. And this was the jacket he was wearing that night, and the jacket was lying crumpled on the closet floor. So again, he shot her point blank in the mouth. He tried to dispose of any evidence he could. He tried to clean her up. He tried to get rid of his jacket. Crazy. The deputy coroner conducted the autopsy on Lana and concluded that Lana died from a single gunshot wound to the head and neck. On the left side of her tongue, there was a bruise consistent with blunt force trauma that could have been caused by the gun's barrel, but not by the bullet. So meaning there was a struggle that she had the gun being forced into her mouth and she struggled to get the gun out of her mouth. And they found other injuries on Lana suggestive of a struggle too. There was a bruise on the back of her left hand, which had been caused by blunt force trauma that had been inflicted prior to death. There were bruises on the back of her right wrist and on her right forearm, also caused by blunt force trauma. And all of these bruises had been inflicted during the same event, and they were consistent with a struggle, with Lana having been grabbed or hit. And he concluded that Lana's death was a homicide. So the thing about this case is, a lot of people in forensics, they were like, well, it's very unusual that intraoral gunshot deaths, meaning a gun in the mouth death, were mostly suicides, and it was rarely a homicide. But it can happen. And this is what happened here. So the defense was again trying to say that Lana killed herself. The coroner concluded that she died due to a homicide. So right there, point blank period, that's all that we need to say. The coroner did agree though that intraoral gunshot deaths were usually suicides and rarely homicides, but in this instance, it is a homicide. And there was no reason for her to kill herself because she was extremely happy with the fact that her career was turning around for her. Just days and weeks before her murder, she was looking forward to jumpstarting her career. On January 9th of that year, 2003, Lana and her mom picked up a couple copies of headshots that Lana was planning to use to apply for modeling and acting jobs. And she had an upcoming modeling job for a print advertisement with Simons, which was a cell phone company at this time. And the photo shoot for the advertisement had been scheduled for February 8th, which was less than a week after her murder. Not only that, but the day before her murder, she made plans to attend a party. And she wrote an RSVP to this friend saying, "Can't wait, love, Lana." And also the day before her murder, she and her mom went shopping for flat shoes that Lana could wear while working at the House of Blues because her feet, you know, were hurting. She needed good shoes to support herself while she was walking around all day. She ended up buying 8 pairs of flat shoes, which her mom paid for. And when they went to part ways for the day, she said to her mom, "Thank you for the shoes, Mom. I love you and I'll call you tomorrow." So she had no intentions of killing herself. She had no plans of killing herself. And the fact that his defense lawyers were really trying to paint her as this woman that was destitute, that was a failed actress, that was embarrassed by the fact that she was only doing B-list, C-list roles. And they played the showcase reel that she made and they almost made fun of her. They had no respect for her. And they, again, used the fact that she had her broken wrists as a way to say she couldn't do what she wanted to do. And she was destitute and she was suicidal. But That doesn't make sense at all, because why would any suicidal person go to someone's house that they don't even know, somehow scope around the house to hopefully find a gun, and then kill themselves there? That's not how it happens. That's just illogical. So the defense team was really trying to say, listen, she killed herself. And the forensics team that was on Phil Spector's side of the argument here on his defense, they were like, listen, this is consistent with her putting the gun into her mouth and pulling the trigger, and he had no blood on his clothes. You know, the trial happened. It happened on March 19th, 2007. For all these years, while the trial was, you know, starting to form before it happened, he remained free on $1 million bail. But like I said, this trial was televised. It's just so sick how the defense was really trying to paint Lana as this like failed actress that was ready to kill herself because she couldn't act or work. She can't speak or defend herself. And they want to paint her out to be this failed actress. But the prosecuting team did a fantastic job at laying out all the groundwork. And unfortunately, though, it's crazy how this trial ended. First was that the jury came back on a hung jury. So they could not acquit him or convict him. And I believe, from my recollection, it was a 10-2 guilty, not guilty. So the jury just couldn't come to a decision. Those two people that found him not guilty, they couldn't form a unanimous vote with the 10 others that said he was guilty. So the first trial ended with a inconclusive hung jury, which is unfortunate. But while that seemed like it was a setback, the prosecuting lawyer came back and he said, I am not stopping until I get this man in jail. So there was a second trial that happened, and this happened in 2008 in October. And now for this trial, it was not televised, but the prosecution basically played the same type of way that they did the first time, but he did not have his defense lawyers in this trial. He had a different lawyer representing him in this trial. And I just think they didn't do a fancy job, because let's just say this, okay? This was coming off of the heels of the O.J. Simpson trial, right? Which was showing that rich men in Hollywood could get away with murder. They could get away with this stuff, right? And they had very fancy, flashy Hollywood type lawyers trying to defend Phil Spector, right? But a lot of the jury could see through that, but still, there was a hung jury for a reason, because some people believed that maybe she did kill herself, right? Phil did not have this fanciful defense when it was happening the second time. He had a lawyer that probably didn't do that great of a job. But the case went to a jury on March 26, 2009, and 19 days later, on April 13th, the jury returned a guilty verdict. Thank God. So this man was finally found guilty for murder in the second degree of Lana Clarkson. And finally, her family got justice. He couldn't wear his wigs in jail. So in the photos, he looked like really decrepit. And I have no sympathy for Phil Spector. I don't. He was sentenced to 19 years to life in prison. And as you can well imagine, he died in prison. He died there. Thank God for that. And that is justice, truly. The absolute rise and fall of this man's story is something that is quite remarkable, because he really was at the top of his game. He was the most famous, recognized music producer in the industry in the 60s and the 50s. I mean, anything that he touched, it turned to gold. And he was a music prodigy by the time he was like 21. He had his own company by the time he was like 21, 22, 23. Like, he was doing the most. And that's a whole other type of incredible life that he had there. And that's another kind of feat that he had. But at the same time, just because someone was really rich and famous and he did a lot of good things in the music industry does not mean that he's a good person. And he was an absolute shitty person. He was a horrible, wicked man that clearly hated women and that only used women for one thing, right? That didn't see women as something to love and cherish, that he saw them as a commodity, as a tool for his fame. It's just sick and disgusting. And he always maintained his innocence, obviously. Just absolute tragedy all around with this story. He fell from grace really, really, really hard, and he died in prison. And you know what? That, I think, is his karma. So I have nothing really more to say about it. That is the story of Phil Spector's rise to fame, his fall from grace, and the murder of Lana Clarkson. I hope that all of you guys have a wonderful day. And I hope that you all had a nice holiday season and that the new year will bring you a lot of amazing times and well wishes. So I look forward to seeing you guys next Wednesday with another episode of On The Mix. Thank you guys for listening. If you would like to follow me on Instagram, I have an Instagram for the podcast. I'll leave the links down below. If you also would like to monetarily support the podcast so I can do better episodes for you guys and support this show, I will leave links for that down below. You can either do a one-time donation or you can subscribe for a monthly fee of like less than $5 if you'd like to Spotify themselves to support the podcast if you like the show and you like what I do here. Anything is appreciated, but thank you very much. I'll also leave my sponsor with Audible down below. If you'd like to join up to Audible, I get a little commission off of that, just being straightforward. So thank you guys very much for your time. I will see you guys next Wednesday with another episode of On The Mix. Talk to you guys later. Bye, guys.